This message is based on my utmost from a September 10th lesson that we use in My Utmost for His Highest, and it's called Worshiping in Everyday Occasions. So I'm not going to quote, let you know when I'm quoting Oswald Chambers, but understand his insight is highly influencing what I'm saying today. I got to start with a caveat, and that is I hold police officers in the highest regard. I think most of us would agree that being a police officer is a tough job at the best of times. And if my eyesight had been good in my youth back in my 20s, I think I probably would have become a police officer. Like maybe Remsen's going to become at some point. I have two close friends who are retired OPP officers who I love dearly and hold them in the highest regard. Sally and I are currently watching the old Adam 12 series. Anybody remember that series at all? About two patrol officers in Los Angeles. So I really mean that when I say I hold police officers in the highest regard. But I want to show you a video from Hampton Law about what it means to speak with police officers. Because he has a number of videos on YouTube advising people how to interact with the police. And to be honest, if you watch enough of his videos, he paints a somewhat negative view in his advice about how to deal with police officers. He has a somewhat negative view of police officers, you can see. And it may be based on his client's experience or it might be based on his own experience. And when I first saw his videos, I kind of rolled my eyes at them and what he was saying in them. He even kind of looks a little bit like one of those typical slimy defense lawyers you see in TV shows. But a few things have happened recently that caused me to take what he says more seriously than I did before. And so let's just watch. It's only about 2 minutes long. Let's just watch what he has to say.
Now, here is the never-changing rule when it comes to police. If you choose to give a statement to the police, you will now be locked in to that statement. Any deviations or variations from that original statement will now likely be interpreted by the cops as you lying or covering up the truth. Why didn't you tell us this earlier? Are you changing your story now? What exactly are you hiding? By the way, do you know that if you change your report now and your statement, you could be charged with a false report to a peace officer? Because of this, you should never just start talking to the police. Opening your mouth and spewing out the first thing that's in your head, layered with emotions in the moment, is one of the worst things you can possibly do with the police in any situation. Why is this a problem? Because the reality of it is you never just get to say what you want to say. What starts as you telling your story to the police always turns into an interrogation. The cops start asking you a lot of very direct, closed-ended questions. Maybe you're sharing your story. The next thing they say is, how many punches did you throw? How many times did you say you pushed him? Cops are actually staring at the physical evidence in front of them. And as you begin to open your mouth and tell your story, they are comparing what you say to the evidence that they have. And if those two things don't line up, they are going to always interpret it against you as a sign of guilt. It doesn't mean you were lying or making up anything. But in this situation, it's all about what you said, how you said it, and how the cops choose to interpret what you said. And let me tell you, 9 out of 10 times, any officer or detective is trying to get you to say something incriminating or something that they can take and fit the theory of the case that they are investigating.
And it's that last part of the video I want to draw your attention to. It's where he says, let me tell you that 9 out of 10 times, any officer or detective is trying to get you to say something incriminating or something that they can take and fit the theory of the case they are investigating. See, police want to take the evidence and they want to fit it into the theory. And before we jump all over police officers, this is a basic human part of human nature to do this. We tend to try to conform the evidence to our theories, rather than conform the theory to the evidence. This happens all the time in life. For instance, imagine a couple divorces, and we meet a person who's now divorced, and they tell us about their ex-spouse. And we learn about this ex-spouse through their eyes. We come to know them through their experience. We interpret them through what they tell us. And we come to form an opinion about that person without ever having met them. Even though at some level we all know there are two sides to every story. I guarantee you that if Trillium had, at the time I applied for the position many years ago, gone and sought a character reference from my ex-wife, you would never have hired me, truly. Scientists do this in their research. They conform data to theory. Experts in a field of study select data that confirms their already pre-existing point of view. On YouTube, we get sent recommendations of videos that confirm what we already believe. You almost never see in your YouTube recommendations a video that challenges what you think already. When I fell and tore my Achilles tendon back in mid-July, my mobility was significantly compromised, and many of my regular activities became difficult or almost impossible to do. So I started reading the Sherlock Holmes stories, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I bought the set 10 years ago, never bothered to read them. They're on my bookshelf waiting to be read. And so having some extra time, I started reading the Sherlock Holmes stories. There are 56 stories, short stories, and 4 novels in the collection. And they are extremely well written. I highly recommend them as something worth reading. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a wonderful writer. As probably most of you know, but not all of you, Sherlock Holmes is a private detective who is constantly solving serious crimes like murder, extortion, missing persons, all in the midst of police failure. That's a key thing. All in the midst of police failure. And Holmes' major criticism of the police detectives from Scotland Yard that he works with is that they too quickly develop a theory of the case. And they spend the majority of their investigating time trying to conform the evidence to the theory. And that often leads to erroneous conclusions, including charging people inappropriately, including people being wrongly accused. Holmes' modus operandi is to delay as long as possible forming a theory of the case. He waits until he's had a chance to survey all the evidence, see where the lines of evidence will take him. Sometimes he'll develop a provisional theory in the case, but he's very good at discarding it when the evidence no longer supports it. He excels at following the evidence, even when it overturns his previous thinking. That's what makes him a great detective. And as a side, I think when Jesus says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged, for in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." When he says that, I think he's saying, don't come up with a theory of the case too soon in your dealings with others, whatever it might be. Don't come up with a theory of the case too soon until you've had a chance to review all the evidence. Otherwise, your judgment of the situation or the person will be framed by the limits of your own imperfect theory. And you're going to become a prisoner of your own premature theory because of it. In fact, A Course in Miracles says we can only truly judge a person or a situation when we have all the facts. And since we never have all the facts before us, we should never judge a person or a situation. Only God can properly judge a person or a situation, come up with the right theory, because only God has all the facts. Now, I don't know if we can live practically that way in life, but at the very least, we should be delaying our theory making, delaying the theory of the case before us, trying to collect as much evidence as we possibly can. And when we come up with theories, they should be provisional in nature and subject to being overturned as we get to know more things about whatever is going on in that situation or with that person. Hampton Law says that sadly that's not how most officers and detectives interact with the evidence. Rather, too often the theory comes very quickly in their investigation. The evidence is marshaled to support that theory. And in fact, that's how most of us live in life, truly. We rush to conclusions about situations. We rush to build ill-conceived theories to explain what's happening. We make faulty explanations, and that leads to faulty conclusions and faulty judgments. In another video, Hampton Law talks about conflict between neighbors, and he points out that police tend to take the side of the person who called first, who initiates the call, the person who gets to them first. Why is that? Again, because police quickly develop a theory of the case so that when they get to the other neighbor to see what that neighbor has to say about the situation, they are already attempting to align the evidence to the theory of the case based on what the first neighbor has told them. Now, I don't know if you've heard about a situation in Simcoe, Ontario, around a woman named Wendy Washick. Has anybody heard that story at all? Yeah. I got a picture of her up there. Do you want to show that? There she is. She's 58 years old. She lives in Simcoe. She's an education assistant in a local board of education. She was charged by the OPP a few weeks back with assault with a weapon. Turns out the weapon was a water pistol. Maybe you can, let's go to the, yeah, there it is right there. This is not the actual super soaker that she got charged with using, but it's one from that was at the party that a local neighbor shared with the reporter. It seems that there was a family party at her place, and she was goofing around with a 10-year-old in some kind of water fight. I don't know all the details. And she accidentally shot a spray of water that went through the fence dividing the property lines. And this water spray struck her neighbor while he was cutting his grass. And she immediately went over and apologized for hitting him with the spray of water, but he wouldn't accept her apology. In fact, one gets the impression from the reporting, and of course, this is incomplete, right? We don't have a complete picture here because all reporting is provisional, especially at the beginning part of a story. So any theory about the neighbor has to be provisional as well. But from the information we get in the reporting, he has a reputation of being difficult in the neighborhood. In the neighborhood, people see him as a difficult person to get along with. And instead of accepting her apology, he called the police. And the police came and spoke with him, and according to Washick, the police never came over and interviewed her or anybody else at the party who were observers of what happened. And if this turns out to be true, that means that the OPP seemed uninterested in finding all the facts for the case. Instead of collecting all the evidence, they arrested her and charged her with assault with a weapon. Although, interestingly, in the report, they don't actually identify the weapon used. Think there's a reason for that? Think they might be laughed out of the public square? Yeah, they only let you know when it's bad, right? The whole thing would be kind of amusing, wouldn't it? The whole thing, you know, water spray going through the fence, striking a neighbor. The whole thing would be rather funny, except that she got suspended from her job, right? It's with pay, but she can't go to work now because she's got a criminal charge pending against her. And there was a GoFundMe campaign started to help her with the legal fees. They hired a lawyer, and the lawyer advised them to try to raise $10,000. Because if everything gets done before trial, if it can be resolved before trial, it's going to cost $10,000 to meet the charge. That's not if you go to trial. It's going to be many tens of thousands more. Imagine that. Like, how can an average person get justice in our society when the preliminary proceedings of a relatively simple charge cost $10,000 to defend against? Washick raised $10,000 on GoFundMe, but her account got frozen because GoFundMe won't allow you actually to raise money for the defense against a criminal charge. That's amazing in itself. The state gets to claim all the resources that come from our taxes, but you as an individual can't go to your community and raise money through GoFundMe to help you mitigate the cost of defending yourself. These moments come up in life, like the one Wendy Washick is experiencing, like a thunderstorm racing across the sky. One moment we're rushing across the street, and then all of a sudden we trip. And the next moment we got a broken arm, or we got a dislocated shoulder, or a broken ankle. We presume that we're ready for the battles of life that come towards us. When we're confronted with a true crisis like Wendy Washick is, and it's still relatively minor when you think about the big stories, something much worse could be coming towards any of us. We think we're ready to face the crisis But the truth is, of course, the crisis is only going to reveal the character that's already existing in us. Crisis doesn't make you better. Crisis reveals to what reveals to the to life and to yourself what you already are. Do you presume that if you were confronted with a tough situation, that you would rise to the occasion? What makes you think that you would? On what basis do you have this opinion? What's the evidence for this? You have a theory that you might rise to the occasion, but what makes you think that this is so? What if God was calling you or me to something really hard in life, to confront a real hardship in life? Do you imagine yourself saying, if it's God calling me to it, I'll step up and do it. I'll allow something like this to happen in and through my life. I will rise to the occasion of what God calls me to. The true answer, of course, is that you won't rise to the occasion unless you have done so on God's training ground. If you're not meeting the challenge of the little task closest to you right now, meeting the challenge of the moment, whatever it might be, if you're not meeting that situation with a sense of determination and patience, equanimity and composure, what makes you think that when the big thing comes along, the big enchilada comes along, that you will inevitably rise to the occasion? See, unless we've trained for these moments, there's no reason to think that we won't falter. When the challenge comes to us, and crises do come to us in life, they will come to us. They don't, as they say, create character, they reveal it. It's how we respond to the little adversities in life, the little challenges they bring to us, that prepares us for the big storms that will come at some point. A couple of weeks ago, actually last Sunday it was, I was driving on Sunday morning to Trillium, and I turned from Maple Grove onto Speedsville Road, and it was early, like 8:45. There wasn't a car to be seen in any direction. And I'm driving along, and all of a sudden this pickup truck pulls up to the road, and he just pulls out in front of me. And I'm looking around. There's not a car to be seen. There's no car behind me. He pulls out in front of me. And in that moment, I say to myself, that's okay. That's okay. I put the brakes on, and I say, that's okay. He must have some kind of need to get out quickly. I don't have all the information. I can't judge what he just did. Maybe there's an emergency. He has to rush to get to where he wants to go. He has good reasons for doing what he is doing, and braking in front of him is okay. Except that he starts driving then at 50 kilometers an hour in the 70 kilometer hour zone, right? And I'm thinking to myself, what was that all about? Why did you race out onto the road in front of me, force me to brake, to drive in a lackadaisical manner down Speedsville? He's not in any rush. And in that moment when I realized the truth, I muttered some words that I cannot repeat here, right? Maybe words that you've muttered in your own life circumstances. And I did a few hand gestures that I can't really show you what they are. And I roared past him when I got the first chance, and I slammed on the horn, and I probably made a few more hand gestures I can't share with you. This is one of those little circumstances that God has allowed to come into my life. It was training ground. It was a training ground moment for me. How do you think I did? What kind of grade would you give me? I give myself an F, to be honest. This was an opportunity for me to deal with a minor adversity. I can't imagine, and if I can't manage this moment in a Christ-like manner, if I can't manage something little like that, how am I going to deal with real adversity in life when it comes to me? How am I going to rise to the occasion when God calls me to do something hard? My basic mistake was that I took the evidence I had and I came up quickly within seconds of a theory of the case, a theory to explain what had happened. And when that theory was overturned, I had a new theory. I had an opinion about who this guy was. He was a bleepity, 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 bleep. And he deserved my contempt and my rebuke, and I willfully and joyfully gave it to him. Upon reflection, I realized this event was a place where I was meant to worship God. I was meant to worship God in that moment. We think that worship is showing up on Sunday mornings, and it is, of course. We think worship is singing a few songs together, hearing a scripture read, we pray together, we hear a sermon, then we go home. We think that's a summary of our worship life, but those training ground events in life, those little events that you have, that you meet on a daily basis, these are also places where we worship God. It's where the worship of God occurs, in these little places. This is worship in the everyday occasions of life. And it is here where our Christ-likeness is fashioned by God. Not in the big crisis, but in moments like these. It's in these moments we are disciplined to follow Jesus. We tend to want to live like Nathaniel, relaxing, reclining with a juice or a drink under the fig tree, content, contemplating life in our relaxed, controlled environments. Woe to anyone who disrupts our cloistered, controlled life. Nathaniel lived that cloistered life under the fig tree, and he's disturbed by his friend Philip. He mutters, Philip invites him to come and see Jesus, and Nathaniel mutters, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Perhaps he muttered some other words that weren't written down. Perhaps he made a few gestures that they didn't record. At some point, our cloistered life will be disturbed. Just like Wendy Wasik's life was disturbed. Her cloistered life was disturbed. Someone or something's going to be knocking away on your front door. Someone's going to come to the front door of your life. They're going to knock away. This is a moment of training. Each time it happens, it becomes an opportunity for our own private worship of God to take place. And when I was sitting behind that pickup truck on Speedsville Road, it could have been very different. I could have seen this as a time of prayer with the Lord. I could have remembered a Bible passage or two as I was driving. Even begin singing one of the praise songs we do each Sunday, you know, like, "Nobody loves me like you love me, Jesus. Open the door, heaven is knocking." I could have remembered to sing one of those songs. I could have used the slowness of the moment as a chance for a two-minute worship with Jesus. I could have contemplated on what it means to meet momentary adversity in life. It would have been a wonderful training opportunity for me. Worship God in your present circumstances. Worship God in your present circumstances. Find moments for prayer or Bible study in your adversity. Let this be a time of training for you. If you do this in the small places, I guarantee you that when the large adversity comes towards you, like of the type Wendy Wasik is facing, you'll be ready. You'll be ready. If your worship is right in your private relationship with God, then when he sets you free from all your theories and all your inadequate and rushed explanations, you'll be ready. You'll be ready. It's in the unseen life, which only God can see, that we have become perfectly fit. When the strain of the crisis comes, we can be relied upon by God and by our neighbor, those who live around us. We can be relied upon to meet whatever it is that comes towards us. We can be relied upon to meet whatever comes before us with the grace and goodness of God.